Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock Central Time on the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jay Pearson for Celeste Quinn. And now an archived interview from November of this year, of last year, I guess. Just remember, even though you will hear solicitations for phone calls, and you will hear phone calls in the next hour, this program is pre-recorded, so please don't call today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Did you know that some urban crows have learned to recognize a fast food logo? They'll swoop in on refuse with the logo, passing over plain bags containing the same food. Crows and their relatives in the corvid family are smart. They're also social creatures. And on the program today, we will feature stories of crows and humans. We'll talk with the authors of a new book from Yale, In the Company of Crows and Ravens. Our guests are John Marsloff and Tony Angel. John Marsloff is professor of sustainable resource sciences and professor of wildlife science in the College of Forest Resources at the University of Washington. Tony Angel is a freelance artist and writer who lives in Lopez, Washington. He illustrated the book In the Company of Crows and Ravens. In this book, Angel and Marsloff look at the ways that crows and humans interact, our shared connections. They suggest that crows and ravens have culture, and that cultural evolution is an important reason why they live so successfully with humans. And here are a couple of other observations from the authors that are fascinating. To a surprising extent, to know the crow is to know ourselves. Crows and ravens are more like monkeys, apes, and people, and less like other birds. John, Tony, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be here.
You're very welcome.
Would the two of you give us some examples of how human language, art, culture, and religion have been influenced by our interactions with crows? Let's start with John Marsloff.
Sure. There's a multitude of ways they've been influenced. Our language has easily seen the influence. And if you look in any dictionary, you'll see many words that are derived from either raven or crow as a word. And when we did this, we looked up a variety of other animals and found that no other animal has influenced our English language, at least, to the extent of crows and ravens. So some examples of raven influence would be the word to rave, or to be ravenously hungry, or to have a raven black hair, such items like that. And with crows, of course, we have the crowbar and crow's feet and the crow's nest up on a ship.
Yeah. Tony, you want to add anything to that list?
Well, I think we could also not only take the names, but we can look at the design that we have derived in some of our tools. John has just mentioned the crow's nest, realizing that crows do tend to build at the top of the tree where they can get a good view of anything coming their way, anything they might take advantage of or be aware of. So a crow's nest on the top of the ship serves the same purpose. A crow bar is very much designed around the foot of the crow. Early observers of tools realized that a versatile bird like the crow can do all kinds of things with both its beak and its feet. So it wasn't too long before we started to design tools that were based on what the crow was already doing.
Yeah. What about in our art? I'll mention here that that little interlude of music that we played between the newscast and my introduction is called Musette for a Magpie.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you watch the corvids in general, and that's what we would encourage everybody to do and start to discover like we did, how versatile they are and inquisitive and insightful. A magpie is extremely active, and that music that you played was very suggestive of the way a magpie moves through its environment. There are, of course, numerous images in art. The Edo period in Japan celebrated the crows for all kinds of reasons, ravens as well, but particularly crows. Shinto religion revered the crow for filial devotion, taking care of the parents as young birds, and of course the parents themselves being devoted to their young, and in their art forms of screens and paintings and lacquered boxes, definitely celebrated in art the image of the crow.
Yeah. Now, in some places, crows are seen as pests. In other places, as you mentioned, they are viewed with reverence. Are they found the world over, and how do attitudes toward the crow differ around the world?
Well, crows and ravens, the genus Corvus, which are the large black or potentially black and gray or white birds that we're familiar with, are found throughout the world in the northern hemisphere. They're not found in the New World in the southern hemisphere, so not in South America or Antarctica. But all the other continents have at least one crow or raven, and most of them several species.
Yeah, and why do our attitudes differ? I mean, once we sort of see them, humankind, we can see them as pests, and other times we see them as something that is worth study, observation, and worth some respect.
Something that we discovered was that it's a cyclical matter. Throughout time, these birds have been initially, I think the caves at Lascaux some 30,000 years ago recognized the raven-headed image of the spirit of the hunt in a reverential way. And they could not escape the fact that these were clever, competitive birds and had, as I said, initially respect. But what we had found that over time, the cyclical nature of these attitudes is often influenced by what they saw these birds doing. And when they were associated with death, as often would occur in the history of humankind, they would scavenge and forage on the bodies of their human brethren. The people would observe them and begin to have a sense of disdain for them. And then once they move through that cycle again, there'd be a period of admiration and start to show up in the art, and they'd see the more subtle behavior that they could admire, they meaning we as humans. So it's been an off-and-on relationship.
Yeah,
and in fact, it's somewhat seen in other animals as well. More in the past, as Tony indicated, perhaps as we saw them doing despicable things like eating our friends, that certainly would turn off most people to enjoying the bird anymore. But in the more modern world, it seems to be more of just annoyance more than anything that's turned off people's attitudes towards crows and ravens and other very abundant wildlife that tends to live with us. And for example, the large roosting aggregations of crows are often persecuted because they're noisy and perhaps might spread some disease, but it's more annoyance with the noise and perhaps the scary images of Hitchcock's The Birds that they conjure up in people's minds that leads us to persecute them. And in fact, I think Illinois still holds the record for persecuting these with the greatest vengeance. And back in the early 50s, there were over 300,000 crows killed in Illinois at one roost that was just bothersome to people.
Yeah. You say that you're convinced that crows and people share a long and storied history, and this has subtly molded both us and crows, the members of the corvid family. Is this different from the domestication of animals and the interactions, the relationships between humans and animals?
Well, we actually argue that domestication may be kind of one endpoint or the extreme endpoint of this cultural coevolution that we describe in our book. And the idea is that certainly as social animals interact, they can modify one another's culture. And if we define culture quite pragmatically as the traditions that develop from socially learned traits that are passed on among individuals that live together, and social animals are very good at doing that, then we can talk about the culture of animals responding to human cultural things. And domestication would be the extreme form of that, where we have, as people, have basically become the sole providers and sources of selection that happen to the culture and also, of course, the morphology of the animals that we're domesticating, so that they become very, very closely and intertwined with us and in fact, almost wholly dependent upon us for their survival. And that's where it differs a little bit with respect to what we describe for crows in the wild. While we've molded their behavior quite a lot by our actions, be they direct or indirect, the crow is still perfectly able to survive and carry out its duties in the wild. It doesn't have to live with us. It seems to rather choose to live with us.
Yeah.
I think just to add one additional point to John's, which I think clarified it nicely, a crow and a raven remain wild. I don't know that there has been any successful effort to domesticate. And one might even question, well, why would you want to domesticate a crow or a raven? But on the other hand, we've taken any number of birds, including, of course, poultry, and domesticated them to our benefit. And crows have been eaten over time, wild crows. But in terms of having them reproduce in captivity, raising them for our food source, it's not been possible. Well, we don't know that anybody has really tried over an extended period of time. But they have exploited us throughout that time and continue to, with each move we make in modifying our environment, they seize upon it to expand and support their particular culture. Just one piece of evidence after another. You actually opened the program with a reference to an experiment that John and his daughter made. Maybe John could mention that, an exploitation of our fast food.
Yeah.
Well, certainly they become very attuned to the sources of food that we provide. For example, hamburgers and french fries in dumpsters behind local restaurants. And any cue they can get to an opportunity to feed will be seized upon. And as an example, they were able to recognize the golden arches on a bag and go to that sort of bag initially in the hopes that there was indeed food in it.
Yeah. You know, thinking about crows and ravens and this kind of behavior, seagulls came to my mind. They have also learned to live and take advantage of their proximity to people. They follow boats and they clean up, yet they remain cautiously close to us. They don't get too close. So have other birds done the same thing? Are there other examples of this kind of coevolution in wildlife?
Well, I think the seagull variety of species in the gull family is a good example. Again, up to a point, following boats, moving into picnic areas, still remaining pretty dependent on a water source. The gulls have definitely exploited some of our resources that we provided. Vultures as well have scavenged on battlefields and after plagues. But the degree to which they've refined that capacity, again, going to earlier, their intelligence is not nearly that of a crow and a raven. When you look at the size of the brain relative to the body, crows and ravens are on the continuum that we show in our book of the primates. And no other birds other than macaws are even close to that level of having a huge brain compared to the body size. So you look at what these birds are doing to refine this exploitation, and it sort of leaves the seagull in the wake of the boat, so to speak. It's way back there in what
yeah.
it can do.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with that. And we make three kind of points in terms of the sort of things an animal needs to participate in this cultural coevolution. And as Tony says, they need to be smart, so they need to be able to learn by observing others. They also need to be social so that they can have routine abilities to observe others and learn from others. And they need to have access to people. And another great example of this isn't from birds, but is instead from a very social, very smart mammal, and that's the dolphin. And in Brazil, the dolphin has co-evolved fishing strategies with people and relies upon them to signal where food is and also helps herd some of the fish into the nets that the fishers are trying to catch.
Very interesting. John Marsloff and Tony Angel are our guests this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of In the Company of Crows and Ravens. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now on line one, calling us from Champaign. Hi.
Hello. I have a question about, you talked about them being viewed as pests at part of the time and revered at other times. And Illinois is having such a bad history as far as killing them in the past. I wondered, how justified do you think that is? I have just recently learned that the purveyor, the local wild bird owner, is an avid crow hunter and feels it's perfectly fine to shoot crows. And so I wondered what, and there are other, you know, crow hunters around, and I wondered what, to what extent you think that's a worthy bird to be hunted, I guess, for not to eat, but just to see if we could kill him.
Well, John has, I think, a pretty good description of the paraphernalia that we have developed in order to hunt this this adversary. What are some of those, John?
Well, a whole variety, of course, of calls, electronic callers as well as mouth callers, specialized guns and camouflage, and all kinds of decoys that are also used. They're quite an adversary to hunt.
As far as the legitimacy of killing crows in great numbers, one might argue that they're a very easy target. They're set off against their background, and they do require some skills to call them in. I guess they provide some pleasure in taking down such a species, but as far as justifying the killing of them, on the basis of impact on crops or on songbirds or other species that we hold dear, I think that requires a lot more examination. We found, all the way back to Audubon, who celebrated the crow as a species that would eat grubs and other insects that were competitive to people in their crops, he considered them beneficial, to the fact that crows, we find, are not the number one adversary of a lot of our songbird populations. They're the obvious ones we see, but in fact, we've got invasive rats, we have possum, raccoon, we have, of course, our friendly neighborhood cats who do quite a number on our songbirds as well. Not often seen, so the crow gets the blame. So I think we need to be cautious about saying we're killing a bird that's doing us harm. The better argument, if somebody's going to make one, is that we're out there hunting species because they are a worthy adversary.
And I think there are also two kind of sorts of responses to crows that you're talking about here. One would be the sport hunting, and certainly that's not going to likely affect the population trajectories of crows. Although, in the wake of West Nile virus, which has killed hundreds of thousands of crows across the U.S., it could be an additive source of mortality that could be detrimental to the population. That remains to be seen. But I guess a concern I have about crow hunting is that it's really not regulated in any sort of way. There's very open seasons, very liberal seasons. There are no limits, for example, at all. And I guess at this point, many of the game agencies feel like, any dead crow is a good crow. And it doesn't matter how many. And I think perhaps there should be a little more careful thought about how to regulate hunting of crows, just like with any of the other species that we hunt, if we are indeed going to do that.
Hmm. The other thing that I might mention is, we usually eat what we hunt, or at least that's one of the arguments. And I'd like to see more crows consumed, frankly, if they're going to hunt them. John and I have included a nice little recipe in our book for cooked crow, and we found it to be delicious.
Hmm. Where did the expression eat crow come from?
Well, it can be traced to a variety of sources, but most of them lead back to an encounter in the War of 1812, where after the Americans had won, or at least there was a truce with us in the lead, one of the American soldiers was hungry and was off hunting, crossed into British territory at that point, and shot a crow, thinking, in fact, that it was worth eating at that point, which was common. And at that time, though, a British soldier accosted the American and took his gun and asked him at that point to go ahead and eat part of what he had shot, and is in this view being a very derogatory thing because he'd probably been associated with eating garbage or corpses. And so the American took a small bite. The British escorted him back to the border, and as the American crossed the border, he asked for his gun back, and indeed the Brit gave it to him, and the American quickly turned the gun on the Brit and forced him to eat the rest of the crow.
Who's eating crow now?
Right.
You know, one of the things that I mentioned in my introduction is that you write in the book In the Company of Crows and Ravens that to a surprising event, to know the crow is to know ourselves. And you also say that people need crows specifically and nature generally if we're to maintain a vibrant culture. If crows were to disappear, how might we be affected?
Well, I can start an answer to that. I'm sure John has other insights. But to know the crow is to know ourselves. Crows have expanded their populations across the continent and throughout the world, in large part in association with humankind and the kinds of changes we've made in the environment. If we have more crows, it's a direct result of a crow exploiting what we've done, not that the crow is trying to do anything to us. We've disrupted the habitat, changed it, modified it, opened it up with lawns and golf courses and cornfields and what have you. And the crow has just, and the raven to some extent, followed that out. Highways have been a great source of support for the crows and ravens as they've moved across, picking up roadkills and one thing or another. We see the kinds of habits that we have practiced that, in fact, cultivate these populations. We also, by observing crows, can see to some degree what it takes to succeed in nature. And this is a fairly subtle thing that nature's always taught us. How do we fit into nature? How do we find ourselves in a changing world that depends upon resources? Crows are very good at it. If we watch them, maybe we can in turn learn how to do a better job of using those resources in a renewable, sustainable fashion. We would argue that that's a possibility.
Mm. And, you know, I would add to this that I think it's important because our culture has been influenced by nature for such a long time and has taken a strong imprint from nature in terms of the sorts of things we sing about, that we write about, the way we talk. And that connection is certainly frayed in a more mechanized urban world. And in fact, most people live in high-dense urban centers now, and that trend is likely to continue in the future. And as such, we have very little contact with most nature. But one of the sorts of nature that we can certainly contact in our densest cities are crows. And in that way, and the very interesting and exciting way that people respond to them, they can continue to affect our culture, at least as nature's representative, into the future when we live in more and more mechanized settings. Certainly human culture will continue without the crow, but I think it will be a lot less rich.
Yeah. In the book, you offer a number of examples of co-evolution, and at the top of the list is hunting and gathering and expansion of agriculture. Would you take these two topics and sketch out when you start to observe how you see co-evolution of crow and human in hunting and gathering and agriculture?
Sure. I'll take the hunting, gathering, and Tony, you can have the agriculture. How's
Thank
that?
You, John. That's great.
Well, with hunting and gathering, we're really speculating quite a lot in the book on that, and we hope that will stimulate anthropologists, archaeologists, and others to think more critically about how crows and ravens, and probably ravens in particular, influenced early man. Our idea is that as people were scavenging and collecting foods in a very primitive sort of way, as we first evolved maybe 7 million years ago, certainly one of the greatest challenges that we would have faced would have been to keep this food that we worked so hard to get to ourselves. And we would be challenged by predators and, you know, other sources of nature to steal these foods. One of the most pervasive would have been, in our estimation, some of the ravens and crows that lived in Africa with us. Certainly by the time we got to Europe and were doing similar things and hunting on our own, we certainly would have been faced with very wily and aggressive ravens trying to steal food from us, just as they had from other animals and continue to steal from other animals to this day. And in particular, we base our ideas that this thievery by ravens might have forced some of the social behaviors that people had developed at that time and, of course, have perfected to this day. Perhaps living in groups and subdividing our work was in part done to thwart the thievery by ravens. And this was a recent hypothesis put forward for the evolution of sociality in wolves, in that wolves live in larger groups than they need in terms of their energy regainment. They live in larger groups primarily to defend the foods that they've killed, moose and the work that was done, because ravens can steal up to 45 pounds of meat per day from a pair of wolves, and that number is greatly reduced if you have a larger pack. So it's not necessarily the efficiency of hunting that led wolves to be social, but it's the efficiency of defending the food against ravens. And we suggest the same might have affected early people.
Hmm. The example that John has given about the hunting culture of humans and how we modified our social structure and delegation of duty to meet with this challenge by scavenging ravens might be applied to the agriculture as well. As we moved into an agricultural-based economy, the crows and ravens were waiting for us, so to speak. And we found that both in Europe and even in the Southwest with the agriculture and the membrase culture there, the crow had already been 1,000 years ago a presence that needed to be dealt with. And the again, the delegation of duties to deal with a challenger, someone or something that was coming in and threatening your food source, began to emerge. And everything from setting snares to nets in the membrase culture to, in Europe, delegating youngsters to be crow boys. It's recorded in some of the earliest of the literature that these youngsters were out presumably waving their arms around, chasing crows off, and positioning themselves strategically to keep these animals, these other animals, at bay. And eventually, of course, these were supplanted by, for whatever reason we could imagine, by scarecrows, which mm-hmm. then were placed in the fields rather than the actual boys. And we know how well scarecrows work. It takes about two or three days, and crows are right back to work.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champagne on line one. Hi.
Hello. Could you say a little bit about the family relationships of these birds? Are they polygamous, monogamous? What sort of how the young relate to the adults?
Yeah, great question.
Absolutely. And as Tony pointed out in an earlier discussion about some of the art, the filial relationships of these birds and their strong family values were something recognized by early people as they interacted with them. And as we've, as biologists, banded individual birds so that we can track their behaviors through their lifetime, we've learned that in general, the corvids are highly monogamous. They mate for life, and they stay with their mate throughout the year. Maintain these pair bonds for 10, 20, 30 years that they've been observed. Their young are cared for a long period of time so that they're, again, able to learn a lot from their parents, and they are able to occasionally return and help their parents rear their siblings, their younger siblings of a future year. So it's not uncommon for groups of crows in the Illinois area, and especially in the as you go further east, to live in fairly large extended family groups where there might be a male and female parent and up to five young from previous breeding attempts that stay and help those parents raise more young. And usually these are males that stay and females that disperse to other areas.
One of the things that also I think shed some light on that question is the way in which the groups of crows and their families sometimes arrange themselves. There'll be sometimes something close to a colonial arrangement where there'll be several nests in close proximity, and the pairs of birds and raising their youngsters will advantage one another's presence. Should there be a predator like a great horned owl or a hawk in the vicinity, they can all move in to mob and move out the predator that would be a threat to their young. Sometimes you have more solitary nesting because it's advantageous to do that. And John's studies have pointed out, I think, some really important distinctions between John and other studies that have been done between rural and urban crows. The urban center has provided a great opportunity for crows to raise youngsters because it's protected. They're typically, most towns don't and cities don't have people shooting guns off that would take the crows and discourage the crows from nesting there. And those are the crows that can team up and pretty well chase off most intruders to their nests, especially the human intruder. And they're very vigorous, very aggressive, and those are the reports you get typically of people being attacked by crows. They're protecting their young. In a rural setting, on the other hand, where a crow could be shot, they're very quiet as adult pairs around the nest. They retire at a great distance if someone approaches their nest tree, because they've learned quite appropriately that to move in closer could be a threat to themselves. So different behavior in different settings, all focused on protecting those youngsters and the next generation of crows.
Hmm. Does the caller want to follow up?
Well, then does hunting disrupt the family groups quite a bit?
Well, it certainly could affect pair bond stability, and commonly the most dominant aggressive birds will be the first one in, for example, to a decoy, and those would be the adult males. So it would be quite common for hunters to shoot primarily adult males that are coming in not only to drive a rival perhaps out of the area, but also to demonstrate their dominance. And in response, pair bonds could be broken and females will need to obtain a new mate, which they'll certainly do, but it would certainly disrupt that tight social fabric that's been woven through time there.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his questions. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guests this afternoon, John Marsliff and Tony Angel, authors of In the Company of Crows and Ravens. How do crows maintain these relationships that they have? How do they maintain that stability between, you know, an adult male and an adult female, for example?
Well, just like people, and as Celeste, you were saying earlier with a question, to know crows is to know ourselves, they use the same kinds of cues we do, the visual cues, the auditory cues, kinesthetic cues. They are very, very sensual animals, and among other things, of course, they can see in bands of light that we don't see in, and they see colors and gestures, if you will, in the tracks of feathers that are not really readily discernible to us, and they can recognize those distinctive traits of their mates that separate them from all of the other crows that might look uniformly very much the same to us because they're all of the same color. But even more, I think, complex is the range of vocalizations that they have, which you know, we're just beginning to get an insight on. And what John, I think, can shed some light on that as well.
Well, certainly individual recognition of voice is a common attribute of corvids around the world, and it's the primary sensory modality that they communicate in as well. And it's the obvious thing that irritates people or really gets them excited about crows as well. But individuals are recognized by voice just like we can tell each other's voice on the phone, for example, right now. And in that way, they can stay in contact. A mated pair can stay in contact rather easily throughout their territory. Mm-hmm. They also just physically spend a lot of time in close proximity, and they groom one another much like apes do. And in those intimate kind of relationships, the pair bond is just strengthened.
Yeah. Let's talk with another couple of listeners. Next, we're going to talk with a caller who's visiting with us this afternoon from a cell phone on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
I just have a quick, maybe random question. I don't know if the gentleman there could say, why is a group of crows called a murder? And that's just a quick question I'll just take up now. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, again, it's probably their association with the great scavenging that went on during fires and plague that killed thousands and thousands of people. And they were seen in association with death routinely. But if you ever hear a group of crows mobbing a hawk or an owl, particularly a great horned owl, or at least it seems that way to us, their cawing and their terrific vocalization, sounding so aggressive and almost cacophonous in its and deafening in its intensity, does sound like a murder of something. Mm-hmm. And again, that was something that, of course, Hitchcock capitalized in his portrayal of the crow in The Birds. There was a murderous intent to the sound of their voices.
Yeah, I remember once coming out of the house very early in the morning and seeing that happen, a group of crows chasing an owl, and it's most impressive.
Well, John, I mentioned that episode with the eagle. I mean,
in fact, it can be more than impressive. It can be deadly at times for both participants. Crows have certainly been caught by hawks or owls that they've been mobbing, but we had a case here in the Seattle area where a group of crows that was mobbing a bald eagle actually killed it. And in this case, the reason, of course, they're mobbing is at least twofold. One, again, to show off their dominant abilities to other members of their species, but also more functionally just to chase a deadly predator out of the area. And in this particular case with the eagle was in a crow's nest slowly eating the baby crows, and the crows of the pair that was there, as well as neighbors in the area, all attacked that eagle. And it, you know, diving down at perhaps reaching 70 miles per hour and getting hit by a pound of weight in a crow can really inflict some damage, and in this case, killed the eagle.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Is that me?
That's you.
Yeah. I'm familiar with a local study here in Champaign-Urbana where they put radios on a lot of crows and it monitored them more or less throughout the winter, at least, as well as other times. But the interesting thing that I hope I'm not, I don't know if they've published this yet. But
I do know of their work, so it's fine.
Yeah, well, okay, the interesting thing was that the crows, the I don't know whether you call them urban crows, but when they come back in to roost at night in town, there's a tremendous interchange. The same crow maybe stays in one place for a few days, or that he's off to Urbana a couple of miles away, stays there a while. It's like they're constantly have this rather wide-ranging social contact, and I'm just wondering if there's any... why that would be. Is this just straight not having anything else to do, and so they go talk with different buddies, or could there be some survival aspects there, or just any ideas that you might have on that? I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
Sure. There's a variety of reasons why birds join roosts and why they would move between roosts. Fundamentally, they're going to roost to gather information, and perhaps they'll go to different roosts to tap into different bits of information as to where good food sources happen to be located. Or they might just go to reduce commuting costs, and so they'll move between roosts because there's another roost that's closer to where they happen to be feeding at the end of that day. They may also be looking for potential mates and join roosts and foraging flocks that differ from day to day because of the need to try out many different potential mates. And we see the exact same thing here in Seattle and elsewhere, that birds move quite a lot between roosts. And a lot of the birds that are moving are also birds that are not tied to a territory. So during the winter time, when birds are not raising young, they're a lot more free to move, and so they can track these other sorts of food resources or potential new mate resources in a roost and not have to use the same roost over and over as they do during the summer when they're tending their young on their territory, and they want to roost fairly close to that area. The one caveat in the study that was done there was that it was done during a time of great mortality from West Nile virus. And so there may have been other reasons to be moving between roosts, especially at that time, because mates were dying. Other individuals were perhaps finding safer roost locations throughout the course of that disease.
One of the other dimensions that we've mentioned earlier is the curiosity of crows and ravens, something that you can, as an observer, watch a crow and begin to realize that it doesn't miss much. It's always trying to turn something over, preferably for a meal, but sometimes you wonder if it isn't just wondering what's on the other side. And they tend to be explorers, and to move from one area to another may be driven, as John has described, both by seeking another mate, moving out of an area that has been treated aggressively by people, certainly looking for food, but also, and again, it's speculative, for the same kinds of things that drive us, a spirit of curiosity, of wondering, of seeking, something that's moved that population across our continent and around the world through the Northern Hemisphere, and taken it to all parts of the Earth, from all parts of the Earth for corvids, so to speak, except Antarctica. But the raven, as an example, being able to survive very, very well indeed in the coldest of climates in the Arctic and in some of the lowest and hottest places on the Earth in Death Valley. Same bird, two entirely different locations. Something has taken it there, and of course it's been able to stay there as well because it can exploit by strategies the various resources found.
And let's talk with another listener, caller on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I lived in a rural community as a kid, and I remember waking up in the morning a number of times and hearing a lot of crows in the field across the road. I wasn't watching, but I was listening. And there would be, you know, one voice, maybe another one would chime in like they were having a discussion, and then the whole bunch would chime in, and then it would go back to the discussion again, and it kind of sparked the imagination, but I just wondered what was going on, what kind of thing, what are their interactions in those situations?
Well, it's really quite mysterious, in fact, to really be able to fully understand the sorts of dialogues that occur there, because you really need to know each individual in the group and know what bird is responding to what other bird's particular call. But certainly part of what you were hearing must have been individuals in the flock responding to the calls given by the other individual. Perhaps it was a mate responding to its mate's call, just keeping contact with one another, as they will do. Or perhaps the call had a meaning such as an assembly or a disbursement type of response that would lead individuals to quickly chime into that and reinforce perhaps what one individual was responding to as a source of danger or as a potential source of new food.
Hmm. Well, it just always sounded to me like they were, you know, they were holding court or a town meeting or something like that, and so I always wondered about that.
Well, as you were describing that set of calls out there in the field across from your house, I'm reminded of similar kinds of episodes out here on the West Coast where we've heard that kind of exchange, single calls, group calls, single call, group calls. And as John is saying, we're just beginning to tap into understanding once we know what the individual, who the individuals are that are part of that assemblage. But one thing that John and I have discovered, and as this book has began to circulate, is the number of people who have witnessed crow funerals, and even what we would call an execution by crows, where assemblages of crows are milling around with a particular soft but group call around the body of another crow, a fallen comrade, so to speak. What is going on here? We're anthropomorphizing a bit by even calling it a funeral, but on the other hand, it's directly attached to the death of another member of that larger flock. And in the case of a crow execution, we just simply cannot dismiss when observers are coming from very disparate parts of the country and telling us that they, too, have witnessed a crow execution, and where some member of the flock is dispatched by another member of the flock, and there are witnesses to it, by witnesses of other crows as well as a person seeing this happen. So the dynamic is very mysterious.
Yeah, there we've got to wrap it up. One quick question, though, is one of the things that I have noticed about crows and vocalizations is that they vary from region to region.
Yes, dialects.
Dialects.
And those are socially learned dialects. That's been shown in laboratory settings as well as in the wild, that they learn how to communicate within the flock by hearing other members of the flock communicate.
I bet you hear our dialect out here on the West Coast, don't you?
There we have to leave it. I want to thank you so much. It's really a fascinating topic, crows and ravens and the whole family of corvids, and there are more than 40 species in the corvid family. John, Tony, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Our pleasure. You're welcome.
John Marsloff and Tony Angel have been our guests in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of In the Company of Crows and Ravens. The book is published by Yale.
You've been listening to an archive edition of the Afternoon Magazine with your host, Celeste Quinn, here on WILL AM 580. That's Urbana, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason, reminding you to stay with us this afternoon when at 3 o'clock Central Time, we'll bring you PRI's The World Today. The men who overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979, well, they've grown older, but they have not forgotten their ideals. Many are pleased to see the new Tehran leadership return to fundamentalism, but others say Iran's reforms have a long way to go. Next time on The World, two veterans of the Iranian Revolution talk about their nation 27 years after the fall of the Shah. That story from Tehran in the Nay's News at 3 o'clock today on The World, and it repeats again at 7 o'clock tonight. In a moment, we'll take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, starting with the Mercantile Exchange numbers this afternoon. We'll start with those numbers where the feeder cattle finished the March contract at 108.90 today on the high, the low at 107.82.5, and their settlement price at 108.70. They were up 65 cents today. April feeder cattle, 109.90 on the high, the low at 109.05, settlement price at 109.82.5. They were 57.5 higher. And the May feeders, a 110.20 high, low at 109.40. Settlement price at 110.05. They were up 35 on the day. Live cattle futures from the Mercantile Exchange, February contract, 91.75 the high, the low at 19.95. A settlement price there at 91.47.5. And the April live cattle had a high today of 89.57.5, a low at 88.75. Settlement price at $89.10. They were unchanged on the day. Feeder cattle are lean hogs now. February contract, $59.15 the high, the low at $58.85. Settlement price there at $58.92.5. They were up a nickel. And the April lean hogs, a $63.10 high, low at $62.60. Settlement price at $62.92.5. They were 32.5 cents higher. May futures, $68.10 the high, low at $67.70. And the Maine lean hog settled at $68.05. They were up 20 on the day. June contract, a 70-30 high, low at $70 even. Settlement price at $70.17. They finished the day 22.5 cents higher. In just a moment, we'll take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
From the Board of Trade on this Tuesday afternoon, futures in the wheat pit finished like this. The March contract today had a high of 349, their low at 342 and three quarters. Settlement price at $3.47 and a quarter. They were off three quarters for the day. The May futures in the wheat pit, 360 and a half in Chicago on the high, the low at 54 and a half. Settlement price at $3.58 and a half, off a penny and a half. And July wheat, 369 and a half, the high, the low at 64. Settlement price at $3.69, up a quarter. September futures unchanged today, 379, the high, the low at 374. Settlement price there unchanged at 379 for the SEP wheat. And the December contract, 390 and a half, the high, low at 385 and a half. A settlement price at $3.89 and a quarter. They were down a penny and a half for the day. March wheat from the Kansas City Board of Trade settled at $4.13 today, down two, with a high of 414 and a half and a low at 407. July a 414 high, low at 406, and a settlement price at 410 and a quarter, finished the day 2 and a quarter lower. Back in Chicago at the Board of Trade, corn futures finished like this. The March contract down 2 cents today, 220 and a half the high. Low at 217 and a quarter. Settlement price there at 218 and three quarters. They were down two. And the May futures at 231 high. Low at 227 and a half. Settlement at 229, down two and a quarter. July corn off a penny and three quarters today. 239 and a half the high. The low at 36 and a quarter. Settlement price at $2.38, and they were down one and three quarters. September futures finished like this. They were off three quarters, 246 and three quarters the high, the low at 44 and a half. A settlement price at 246 and a quarter, down three quarters. And your new crop December corn, 256 and a half on high, low at 254. Settlement price there, 256 and a quarter a bushel, down three quarters. March contract down a quarter as well, 263 the high, the low at 260. Settlement price off a quarter cent for the March corn 2007 contract at 262 and one quarter. March oats for the day, $1.90 the high, the low at 187 and a half. Settlement price at $1.89, down three quarters. And the May at 188 and a half, unchanged for the day, with a high of 89 and a quarter and a low at 87 and three quarters. Soy complex now, March beans finished a penny lower. 587 the high, the low at 81. Settlement price at $5.83 and a quarter cents a bushel. They were off 1 cent. The May futures, a 599 high, low at 593 and a half. Settlement price at 596. They were down a penny and three quarters. And July contract, a 608 high, low at 603 and a quarter. Settlement price at 606 and a quarter, off three quarters. August futures, 611, the high, the low at 7.5, settlement price at 09, down a penny and a quarter. September contract, 610 and a half in the bean pit for the high, the low at 609, settlement price at 610, down 2 and no beans. That's your new crop harvest month, 620 the high, low at 613 and 3 quarters, settlement price at 615 and 3 quarters, off 3.5 cents for the day. January futures, 623 the high, the low at 19.5, a settlement price at $6.20 and a half cents, they were down 3.